Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Lynelle Engelmeyer joins us this afternoon. She's a certified educational planner with over 20 years' experience in college admissions and financial aid, and currently has had her own college counseling practice and a great website, www.collegeappwizard.com. Lynelle volunteers to work with underrepresented students through a local and national not-for-profit and is the author of a college admission and financial aid workbook entitled Moving Forward, What Teens and Parents Need to Know in the Years Leading to College. Well, it's been about 6 months since you've been on, Lynelle?
Yeah, might be close to that.
It's a big month for you. It's College Financial Aid Awareness Month. By the way, the number to call, 1-800-348-2551. You can tweet us at WAMCVoxPop. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. So it's College Financial Aid Awareness Month, and you have not invited me to the party yet.
I am so sorry, but happy Financial Aid Awareness Month to you.
And also to you.
Thank you.
So what is it?
It's basically to get the word out. It's an educational tool to let people know that there are resources about financial aid. There tend to be a couple of events during this month run by state groups. The New York State Higher Ed runs one. The National Association of Financial Aid Administrators runs one to basically educate people about financial aid and about what you need to do to get it and provide resources to get some questions answered.
Now, I mean, this is obviously was not randomly selected this month because this is a big month for getting ready, right?
Exactly. And for students who will be freshmen in the fall, February tends to be a very big month of financial aid deadlines. Mm. And so January tends to be a time when they're really focusing on getting their financial aid ducks in a row, as it were.
So in other words, the acceptance letters are already in. It goes back many, many years for me, but I seem to recall this was about the time you got the letter saying you're in. But am I wrong?
Well, no, not necessarily. And I would say, you know, some kids have heard already, particularly if they've applied early decision or early action, they've heard already. Some kids have not yet heard. But what happens is you can't wait until you get an acceptance letter in order to apply for financial aid.
See, I don't understand how that would possibly work. In other words, you go through all this effort and you know that there's a lot of work involved in getting these applications for financial aid out and a lot of questions to answer. And then you put it in and then you don't get accepted.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
That is in a lot of cases, it's the chance you take. What happens is if you apply to a school, and a lot of schools will let students know in March, for example, MIT is my favorite. They let students know on March 14th at 1:59 p.m. So it's 3.14159, the value of pi.
I see.
But if you wait until you find out on that date in order to start the application process, which of course takes some time to get through, you really won't have very much time between the time you get a financial aid package back and the time you have to make a commitment. So you have to start the financial aid wheels in motion while you're waiting for that admissions decision so that if you get accepted, they can prepare a financial aid package for you in a much more timely fashion. They will not prepare it for you until they know you've been accepted, but they will know that before the student will know that.
And from our past discussions, and you've been on several times, not every set of forms and paperwork and questions are the same. So you can't just do one set of aid applications, bank it and say, okay, well, I'm going to go to College X, I'm going to go to College Y, and just send the same stuff out.
You can do a good bit of that, but no, not entirely. There's an awful lot of variation. Schools have individual requirements, particularly in financial aid. And for schools that have a very large sum of their own grant money or gift aid that they give out, they want to give it out as accurately as possible. And the FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, which is the main financial aid application that everybody fills out, sometimes is not enough information for those schools in order to decide that they want to give you thousands upon thousands of dollars and they want more information. And so there might be a supplemental form, there might be submission of tax returns and W-2s. There can be all kinds of requirements, and it's not that easy to keep track of.
1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Lynelle Engelmeyer is our guest. It is College Financial Aid Awareness Month. I'm sure you knew that. 1-800-348-2551. So, okay, just putting this out there. You fill out the financial aid stuff, and you send it in before your application is approved. does then someone at the college say, well, you know, Ray needs a 98% of financial aid. He ain't getting in this college, even if his grades are good.
No, most places, the vast majority of schools, will make those decisions independently. Mm. And that's what's called need-blind admissions.
Yeah.
And so they will make a decision on you regardless of your ability to pay. However, that doesn't mean they need to fully fund what you need in order to go there. So,
yeah.
You know, let's say you fill out your financial aid forms and it says you can contribute $1,000 to a $50,000 a year college education. That doesn't necessarily mean that college is obligated to give you the other $49,000. They might give you $35,000. That difference then falls back to you to pay. That's called unmet need.
Yeah.
And you, in all likelihood, will look at that and go, well, I can't do that. I have to choose somewhere else. And
yeah.
So admissions decisions are largely made on a need-blind basis at most places. But that, you know, again, it doesn't mean they will fully fund you and make it feasible for you to go there.
Now, when you walked in the room, you just mentioned in passing the talk that's out there about eliminating merit-based aid. Does this mean scholarships are going to go away?
It's been a debate for a while. I've been reading more about it lately, so it seems to me that debate right now is a bit more prevalent. And there's actually been a movement by some college presidents. There's one in Ohio who I think has kind of led the movement to eliminate merit-based aid. That is aid based on some talent, often academic, maybe leadership, in favor of solely need-based aid.
Now, is that different? Is merit-based aid different from scholarships, or are we talking about the same thing?
It's the same thing.
Okay. So then what about all these huge college football programs?
You know, I don't know enough to say, and nobody has talked about athletics in this. But what happens, be it an academic scholarship, a music scholarship, or an athletic scholarship, you are the thought is one thought of school of thought is that you are giving money to a kid that doesn't potentially need it. And when I say need it, I mean need it in quotes,
right?
According to the federal definition of need. And so what happens is are you not giving it to a deserving student who qualifies to meet your admission standard in favor of somebody you want to attract who, I mean, it could be Bill Gates' child,
yeah,
who qualifies for a music scholarship, and you give them that money regardless of their ability to pay. And in fact, one statistic that I read was that scholarships among lower-income families have grown by about 22% in the last several years.
Mm-hmm.
Among higher-income families, scholarships have grown by 145%.
Ooh, that's very interesting.
And so clearly that money is being directed at a very different place than need-based aid.
But, I mean, clearly there is an advantage to a school if Linnell is the greatest flautist in her high school to bring her in. But yet, if Linnell's folks are well-to-do and can pay, isn't there a happy medium here between merit-based and need-based?
Well, you would think, and what has happened is, while college presidents have said, gee, we'd really like to put more emphasis, or some college presidents have said, we'd really like to put more emphasis on this need-based aid path, what this one college president said was that it is often the board of trustees at the school and kind of other stakeholders who have said no, because there are too many other ramifications to attracting people with a type of talent. It might raise, for example, if I give you a scholarship, I'm a college, and I say, you know, Ray, you, academically, you're fantastic, and you've got these really impressive standardized test scores, and I offer you a scholarship. I attract you to my school, and you raise my help raise my average SAT scores, which then reflects very positively in something like U.S. News and World Report college rankings,
yeah,
which then helps us out recruiting other students. And so some people will say, and it's a little bit cynical, but probably not untrue, is that scholarship money is often marketing dollars.
Right. And college football, there's no better example.
Absolutely. And you look at a college football program, and what happens if you have a winning college football program? Your alumni are excited about it. It makes it a little bit easier to attract students who want that kind of camaraderie in their environment, and who want to spend their Saturdays watching football. So, you know, it's not necessarily about the athlete as an individual,
yeah,
but about what that athlete does to the institution.
Linnell Engelmeyer is our guest. We're talking about financial aid and all the steps to get ready to go to college or have your child go to college. We have a couple of people on the line that I'm sorry I've been blabbing here, but I'd only get to see Linnell every 6 months. We'll get to the phones in a minute. Zach, let's take a break. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551. Your call's coming up on Vox Pop.
Support for WAMC comes from NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. AD George Construction, for over 25 years serving the Pioneer Valley's residential construction needs, remodeling, additions, and more, from design to completion. 413-256-6752. Dam Cafe and Deli, Saugerties, New York, serving breakfast and lunch with chef-created soups, salads, vegetarian options, and homemade desserts. Catering services available, thedamcafeandeli.com. And Saratoga Health and Wellness, a fitness facility providing clinically trained nutritionists and exercise physiologists, designing personalized wellness programs, saratogahealthandwellness.com.
So, you know, we do this little thing called the Fun Drive, and it begins on Monday, February 4th, and we're excited about it, and I hope you are as well. You can do your part now. Get us off to a fast start. The WAMC Lockbox is accepting pledges now at WAMC.org. It's our website. You just click on the Lockbox. You can make a secure donation to WAMC. All of the money in the Lockbox will be added to the total on the first day of the Fun Drive. I believe as of this morning, we were over $160,000. That's a day of the drive. That's a good day of the drive. If you want to shorten this thing, make your pledge now at WAMC.org. We'll throw it in the lockbox and we'll count it on day one. Linnell Engelmeyer is our guest today, and it's Vox Pop, and the number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Dave in Albany, extremely patient. Thanks for being here. You're first.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Good. Okay, so my question is that I am a non-custodial parent. Okay, and I plan to contribute to my child's, you know, college education, which is coming up this coming year. So, do I, as the non-custodial parent, have an obligation to participate in the financial aid application process in terms of submitting my income and filling out forms and that kind of stuff?
It's a really good question, and the answer is maybe, as with the answer with to most financial aid questions. And the question really is a function of where she is going to go to school, or at least where she's considering going to school. And I'll give you an example. If she is, Dave, are you you're a New York State resident?
Yeah.
Okay. So if she applies to only New York State schools, she will only have to fill out the FAFSA, which is the free application for federal student aid, and that's the form that it's the federal form that all the schools use and the state uses as well. For divorced or separated parents, the FAFSA will ask for the income of the custodial parent. That is not defined the same way that the IRS defines it. The custodial parent is defined as the parent with whom the student lives with most in the prior calendar year. And literally, you know, when people say, well, I live with them each half, now pick a day either way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if it comes down to, you know, 51-49, it's the parent who's the 51%. And that is the custodial parent. And only the custodial parent gets reported on the FAFSA. If your child is applying to or considering a private institution, some, not all of them, but some of them will require a supplemental form. Often it's their own application. Sometimes it's what's called the CSS profile, like Cat Sam Sam, okay. Which is a kind of an arm of the College Board, and you can find it at collegeboard.com. There's a section on paying for college, and the CSS profile is listed there. Because so many schools are giving out, and particularly private institutions, are giving out so much of their own money, they want more information. And oftentimes they will collect it on the CSS profile. And one of the things that is part of the CSS profile is a non-custodial parent form. If the institution requires the non-custodial parent form, which most do, then you would be asked to fill that out.
Okay.
All right.
That answers my question. Thanks.
All right. Good luck.
Either way, you got some paperwork to fill out there, Dave. You know, in the case of a college where they don't request the non-custodial parent form, then would it not behoove a set of amicably separated parents to juggle the custodian, the custody, maybe a year in advance, briefly, to handle the financial situation?
It wouldn't be the dumbest idea I ever heard.
I gotta remember that. Oh, wait, I'm married still. Joshua in Wingdale. Joshua, you're on.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I'm 22. I'm a freshman applicant who's been accepted for the March, the spring quarter of the school. And with regards to what you were talking about before, the whole need-based aid thing, what exactly constitutes need? Because, I mean, I live with my parents currently. My dad owns a business. My mom's a nurse. And we still, we wound up being granted maybe $6,000 in financial aid from in grants. And that's not nearly enough to constitute a full education at a private institution, which is what I'm going to. So I don't really understand who determines and how does that work exactly with what is aid, but need-based, I mean.
So this is going to sound really cynical, but the federal government determines what need is. Need actually has a federal definition. And if you're really interested in seeing how that got calculated, and this may not be dollar for dollar the same, but it will give you a very, very good idea. There's a really good website called FinAid, as in short for financial aid, .org. And if you go to that, on the very first page, there's a link called Calculators. On that page, there's a link called Expected Family Contribution Calculator.
I've actually, to be honest, I have actually been through that process, and I just, my real,
well, here's,
it vexes me, you know?
Let me tell you what I was going to tell you is that when you do that, because I actually was just using it this morning, you can ask for a summary or a detailed output of how the formula was calculated. And if you get the detail, you will actually see where is that contribution coming from? Where are they expecting that money to come from? Now, so the first question becomes, what is your EFC? What is your expected family contribution? So I'm just going to pick numbers out of thin air here. Let's say the federal government says your family is capable of contributing $30,000 to your education. Your school costs $50,000. Your need at that school would be $20,000. And as I said to Ray earlier, the school is under no obligation to meet all $20,000 of that need. Their goal is to meet all or as much of it as possible, but they're not under any obligation to meet full need. And so theoretically, what could happen is a school could say, well, we'll give you $6,000 in grant and or scholarship money. Either way, it's a gift. And we'll give you some loans, and, you know, we've just met, you know, maybe 75% of your need. And that could very well happen. So one of the things that happens when you're looking at colleges is, you know, oftentimes you want to consider who met more of my need, who gave me the best package, and in what forms. You know, obviously a financial aid package that is predominantly grants and scholarships is going to be much more favorable than one that is 50-50 grants and loans. And so one of the things in your case that I would do is find out what your EFC is, look at the cost of attendance at the institution, and then determine how much unmet need do you have. If they gave you $6,000 and in their eyes they've met 100% of your financial need or darn close to it, then you probably don't have much of a case to go back to them. The ways you could go back to them are if you have some extenuating financial circumstances that maybe would change the way they look at your EFC. So, for example, I have a family this year where in their past there were some pretty dramatic financial implications for their family. It doesn't show on the current FAFSA. What the dad did was he wrote a letter to the school using very specific dollar amounts, you know, and information. So in X year, here's what happened. It cost us this much money and we're still paying it off. And it was a really legitimate concern. And I think that there is a chance that the school, having that information in writing, always in writing, will go back and make a change to it. So, but the first thing you have to know is how much of their need did you meet? And is it, you know, I would look at the detail of how it was determined and see kind of maybe where that contribution is coming from that doesn't necessarily jive with what your family is going through.
Gotcha.
Joshua, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Liza in East Hampton. Liza, you're on Vox Pop with Linnell Engelmeyer.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'd like your guest to discuss Obama's new deprivatization of what used to be Stafford loans and how this affects people nowadays. I know that students would be required to pay back a certain percentage of their disposable income for a certain number of years, and then the rest could be forgiven. And if people worked in certain public service professions, they could also have their student loans forgiven if they're a certain sort of loan. But I think it's incredibly important, and it gives a lot more people the opportunity to go to school. And, for instance, even if you want to go to law school and you want to do public interest law, you could actually pay your loans back in a responsible way according to this law. Not have to go do work you don't want to do.
I see. What do you think?
Well, so this actually changed several... This deprivatization that Liza mentioned changed several years ago. What happened was the student loan money, the Stafford loan, used to get funneled from the feds through a private lender to the institution, to the academic institution. So, Ray, if you got a student loan, it would be a paper check co-payable to you and the institution.
Right.
And now what happens is the lender, the private lender, has been cut out. So the money gets drawn down from the academic institution directly from the federal government. They have effectively cut out the middle. In an effort to save what they claim is a pretty significant amount of money. I worked at a school. We were one of the first ones to change over. We changed over before it was mandatory. And I have to say, I actually thought it kind of made my life as a financial aid administrator easier. And the students didn't really lose anything.
Right.
I didn't think so.
It helps the schools?
It simplifies a little bit. It really was intended as kind of a money-saving effort for the feds. The other piece that Liza was talking about that I think is really valuable is loan repayment options. And there are numerous loan repayment options. There's a standard repayment, which means that on the what used to be known as the Stafford loan, which is now called the direct loan, the standard repayment term is 10 years. You have a six-month grace period once you finish going to school before you enter repayment. And that's the standard. If you are in a low-paying job, you have up to 25 years to pay that. And if you've made 25 years of on-time payments and you haven't defaulted and things like that, you can actually qualify for loan forgiveness. But it is to have the remainder of the loan after that 25th year forgiven. There are also the public interest repayment options. So if you want to go to medical school and you are willing to practice in a low-income area, there is a loan forgiveness option. That does not mean it will forgive 100% of the loan. Often it forgives a portion for every year you serve.
Right.
You know, same thing with law school. It depends on where you serve, what you do with it, things like that.
1-800-348-2551 is our number. Lynell Engelmeyer is our guest. We'll get back to the phones in a moment. But first, Patrick Donjas, our producer, is here with some stuff from the internet.
We have some stuff.
Yes.
Adam on Facebook asks, Lynell, how would a fully medically disabled parent affect a family's financial need profile?
It really depends. Let's assume that the parent is not newly disabled. That is to say, in 2012, which is the income that the schools are going to be looking at in the next financial aid cycle, because it's always the last completed calendar year. So assuming that this parent was not disabled in 2012, but prior to that, really, it should, the information you use to fill out the FAFSA should be pretty accurate of what you're receiving now. So, for example, the disability probably hasn't changed and things like that. So the information on the FAFSA should probably pretty accurately reflect your situation. If a parent became disabled during 2012, things get a little more complicated because what happens is you always have to use the 2012 tax return. Don't use anything but the 2012 tax return because it's just being entered and nobody's going to read your explanations. What you want to do if you have some kind of extenuating circumstance, whether it's this one or any other one, I had a case where a parent was going to be retiring. In the next calendar year. And clearly that will affect what your 2012 is supposed to be a predictor of 2013. Mm. If 2012 is no longer going to be an accurate predictor of 2013, then what you, the parent or family, needs to do is you need to let the individual schools know in writing, always in writing, Making sure the student is very clearly identified on all correspondence, and always two pieces of identifying information. So, Ray, if I write a letter about my offspring, Raymond Graff, I am going to put his date of birth, his home address, something, so that in case there's another Ray Graff in there, we don't get him confused. And spell it out as clearly as possible. So, you know, I became disabled on X and such a date. Through that date, my income was this dollar amount. After that date, my disability will be this dollar amount. So in 2012, you know, my income was X, but in 2013, it's going to look like Y.
If the student was patient, mm-hmm. in other words, and willing to wait a year in a situation like that where I'm going to be retiring later this year or I've just become disabled and my taxes will reflect that next year, wouldn't it be wise or at least an option just to have the student wait a year to apply?
You could. I really don't think that that's necessary because what happens is, just like I said, you know, on the FAFSA, give them what they ask for and only what they ask for. It is the financial aid administrators at the institutions that have the ability to make what's called a professional judgment change. And professional judgment is an actual term. And if you give them that information, and where you need the patience is following it up, you know, things like that, making sure that you stay on top of it and continue that conversation is where you need the patience. They have the authority to make that change.
Patrick Donges, our producer, you have anything else for us?
That's it, right?
Thank you, my friends.
Thanks.
The phone number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Annie in Saratoga's up. Annie.
Hi. I just wanted to mention something that a lot of people don't know about or they discount. When my daughter graduated from high school 2 years ago, I encouraged her, and it was a fight, believe me, it was a fight, to apply for all these little scholarships that the high school was part of. And I got her to apply to four, and she should have applied more, mom being poor and greedy. And what they are, they're the local ones, the elementary school that gives a $500 scholarship every year. The fire department, civic people whose child has died, et cetera. My daughter, because of my perseverance making her do this, was able to get $4,000. I thought that was substantial. And, I mean, some of them had to be used for books, some of them had to be used for whatever. And I think that parents need to know about these little scholarships. And what you do is, on some high schools, they have it online. Other places, there is a brochure. Now, if you called your child's guidance person now, they'd say, oh, you have to wait until whatever. And then, you know, at least you'll have a date that you'll know where the kid can find out about these things. But, I mean, $4,000. Absolutely. And one of them, it goes for each year, and it's for books.
Well, and let me tell you, Annie, what I do is I tell students there are two places that I suggest they look for scholarships. The first place is always the guidance office. For exactly the reasons you stated, they are a great source of the local ones. And the other places are there's some really great websites that have the ones that are a little bit larger in scope, the more national ones. And those websites would be ones like FastWeb, FASTWEB.com. My College Options, I believe, has one. There's a whole host of them on the web that I think are worth spending a little time with.
Annie, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Jean in Middletown. Jean, you're on.
Hi.
Is it Middleton or Middleton?
Middletown.
Ah, how are you?
I'm good. My question is, I have three kids, two of whom already finished college, one in a private school, one a state school. So I've been through this whole process before. But my youngest is going this year, and I just wonder if there's anything really different that I have to be concerned with this year over the past two kids.
And do you mean specifically in the financial aid process?
Correct.
Different. You know, it's a variation of a theme from what you've done before. It's not horribly different. There are some questions that are different. For example, in determining whether a student meets the definition for being independent, there are the questions that you answered for the other two, and now there are a couple more questions on there.
Mm-hmm.
They hit probably a fairly small but important percentage of the population, so that might not be you know, important to you. Mm-hmm. You know, I would say most of it's a variation of a theme. I always think the hardest part is not, well, maybe filling out the forms, but even harder than that is knowing, A, what forms you need to fill out, and B, by what date. Because, you know, money is finite, and applying after deadlines can be a really crucial mistake.
Mm. Okay.
All right. Jean.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks a lot. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. We'll take a short break here and be back with Lynell Engelmeyer and the home stretch on Vox Pop.
Support for WAMC comes from Ashokan Center, Olive Ridge, New York, presenting The Winter Hoot with music by Amy Helm, Mike and Ruthie, and more. Activities for all ages and local food, February 1st through the 3rd, ashokancenter.org. Cafe La Perche, Hudson, New York, Boulangerie, Lounge, and Bistro, featuring European wine selections, dinner menu with bistro fare served nightly, cafelaperche.com. And Capcom Federal Credit Union, offering home mortgages, auto loans, checking, financial planning, and more, capcomfcu.org. And Beacon Institute for Rivers and Estuaries of Clarkson University, presenting River University, a 6-credit environmental undergraduate summer program, classes in Beacon and aboard the Clearwater, riveruniversity.com for online application.
Phone number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Lynell Engelmeyer is our guest, and her website is College App Wizard. That's APP Wizard, collegeappwizard.com. The slogan, no nagging, less stress. And frankly, that can apply. I mean, I hope we can apply that to all of our lives in some way. No nagging, less stress. Kathy and Liberty, you're on. Kathy.
Hi. I'm calling because my son got his BA in 2006 from a private school, and he had some financial aid. But because I was working at the time, he did not qualify for a Pell Grant. And after spending 3 unemployed years in his field, anyway, he decided to go back to school and get an engineering degree. And so he's working on that now, and he's transferred from our community college to a 4-year school. They have said, FAFSA says, that he is not eligible for a Pell Grant because he already has a degree.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if there's any way to appeal that, because he never had the Pell Grant when he first went to school.
I think you're going to have a really hard time with that one. There are instances in which you can appeal financial aid decisions, but one of the federal government's definition is that Pell Grants are reserved for first-time undergraduates. And so oftentimes, once you have received that first bachelor's degree, a lot of financial aid options are no longer on the table, and it is by virtue, whether or not you received it the first time. I never got it the first time, but if I went back for a second bachelor's degree today, I'm not getting it now either because I already have that first bachelor's degree. I think that one, I would be surprised if you came up positive on that one.
Yeah, okay. So your website is
Ray. Ray, that's me.
Ray.
CollegeAppWizard.com. CollegeAppWizard.com.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank
Kathy,
you.
Thanks a lot for the call. So, you know, FAFSA, and it's a formula, and you plug in your taxes. There is no recourse to write them a letter and say, hey, wait a minute, this is completely off.
There is no recourse to write them a letter, meaning FAFSA.
Yeah.
But there are instances, the FAFSA is really the government's attempt at putting every American family on a level playing field. Not every American family belongs on a level playing field. There are extenuating circumstances. The FAFSA does not give you a chance to express them.
Okay.
And don't try, because it'd be like barking up the wrong tree.
Okay.
Where you really want to take that information is to the financial aid officers at the individual schools to which you are applying.
Okay.
You absolutely have to put the information in writing. And the reason that I keep harping on that is because what happens is, if as a financial aid administrator, if I make any kind of professional judgment change, and the government comes in to audit it, if I do not have it carefully documented, I, the school, am liable for that money.
Okay, that makes perfect
sense. So that's where the recourse comes from. Now, there's no guarantee that a school, again, the school can say, no, we're not buying your story and we're not going to make a change. But, you know, if you have a pretty legitimate argument, most schools will be pretty gracious about that.
Let's go to Lisa in the Berkshires. Lisa, you're on.
Hi, this is Lisa. I'm driving, so I apologize if my reception is bad.
Okay.
I have two questions. I'll pose both of them in case I lose you.
All right.
My first question is, I will be the custodial parent who is putting my income into the FAFSA form. And my question there is, my daughter may defer. How, if I go ahead and do FAFSA and they offer her a financial aid package, I know you have to reapply for financial aid every year. If she defers, will the financial aid package that they offer her go with her deferment, or will it be based upon the
Great
new
question.
Application next year?
That's a really good question, and it'll probably be the simplest one I answer all day. The question is, no, you have to reapply, and they will give her a new financial aid package next year.
My second question is, on the supplemental forms that the colleges require, if they are looking for the non-custodial parent's income, if that income is from a business where the taxes are not done as quickly as they could be for an individual, how do you deal with that? I mean, do you just have to somehow get them done, or do the supplemental forms go, are they okay with an estimated?
Oftentimes on the non-custodial parent form, and I just filled one out the other day I helped somebody fill one out. But on the non-custodial parent form, the school doesn't always ask you to submit the tax return. They ask you for the information from the return, but they don't always ask you to submit it. Some may. And what happens is when you submit it, oftentimes they'll say to you, is this from a real return or is this from an estimated return? And you only have to submit the return if it is specifically requested. So in a case where it's the non-custodial parent form, I think what you're going to end up doing is just estimating the current year taxes on that one.
But not definitely.
Okay. Great. Thank you so much.
I think you're not definitely going to have to submit them.
Okay.
The taxes.
All right. Let's go to Carrie in Boston Spa. Carrie.
Hi. I have a question concerning graduate school. I know that financial aid is no longer available. My son wants to go on to graduate school, hopefully medical school. And do you have any resources that we can go to find out the best way to do college applications for medical school and how to finance such a thing?
You know, unfortunately, once you have that first bachelor's degree, the financing options become significantly more limited. And so there aren't great options. Normally what happens for things like PhDs is that a lot of the funding comes from the institution itself. So you'll hear about people who get a fully fund, you know, their PhD fully paid for. That's usually because the school itself is footing the bill. So in a case like that, you would go directly to the institution. More often than not, medical school is paid for mostly out of loans, though, as an earlier caller mentioned, there is a loan repayment option for people serving in high-need areas. I know people who have gone through the military, and the military has paid for medical school. And so those are probably the two ways of medical school financing that help get around the nothing-but-loan situation.
All right.
Is it just a quick question, if I could? Is there a resource, or like you have this website? Is there such a person that we could go to help us navigate the applications for medical school?
Ooh, you know, I have to say the amount I've done with medical school is not hugely significant, and so I can't really answer that well.
Could you call the medical school and say, is there someone who you might recommend to help us guide us through this process?
You can always ask. I don't know, you know, what they're going to say, but I guess it can't hurt to ask.
Okay. Carrie, good luck. Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Linnell Engelmeyer, our guest for another 12 minutes here. Marcus in Millbrook, you're on.
Hi there. Well, I have a question because I'm a non-traditional student, and I've been living independent since 2008, and I'm confused because according to the IRS, I'm an independent, but according to FAFSA, I'm a dependent, so I don't know how to rectify that.
Okay, so first question, Marcus, can I ask you how old you are?
22.
You are 22 years old. Okay. By the federal government's definition, which again, by the FAFSA's definition, which as you accurately pointed out is very different than the IRS definition, you are a dependent student. The ways to be an independent student, according to financial aid, briefly, are that you are an orphan or ward of the court, or were until you were 18 years old. You have legal dependents of your own other than a spouse. So you have children of your own. You are a veteran of the U.S. Armed Forces. You have a first bachelor's degree. You are homeless. There's one or two others that probably don't apply. And my guess is if I said, do you answer yes to any one of those, you're probably going to say no, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so you would be in a situation where you would be looking for what's called a dependency override. And we've talked a little bit about the fact that there are instances in which you can appeal your situation to the financial aid office. And that's what you would be looking at. It would be up to the financial aid office at a particular school to determine whether or not they want to grant you a dependency override. Most places are probably not going to do it because this is a choice you've made, for example. If you just decided, well, I kind of felt like moving out on my own and, you know, I have dinner with my parents every Sunday night and they're really cool and they let me do my laundry there, you're probably not going to get the dependency override. How I've done it for students in the past, or the kinds of students that I've done it for in the past, are students where it was not feasible to live at home. It might be because of cases of abuse, and that could be emotional, physical, substance. Those are, for me, have most often been the cases where there's been a dependency override involved, where the home is just not a healthy or a feasible place for mm-hmm. that student to be. And those would be cases where you could appeal to the financial aid administrator at the institution for a dependency override. And I talked before about the fact that you have to put it in writing, which you will have to do. They may also ask you, for whatever your situation is, to be verified by a third party. It could be a counselor, an employer, a clergy member, something like that. Again, simply because if they're audited, that's the requirement they have to meet.
Marcus, thanks a lot for the call. Tommy on Facebook asks, I'm a custodial parent. I live in a house upstate. My wife's primary residence is in New York City. My wife is not the mother. I understand I can apply for financial aid based on my low income. My question is about proof of income. I have heard that my wife and I have to file income taxes separately. Is this true, or can I just file, you know, some kind of income form?
So what happens on the FAFSA is that they want the income of the parent with whom the student lives with most,
yeah,
and that parent's spouse, whether or not that that parent is the mother of the children.
Okay. Yep.
So in the case of a father and a stepmother, if they are legally married, then they have to put both incomes, regardless of how they file. It really has to do more with your marital status than your tax filing status.
Okay. Wayne in Germantown, you're on Vox Pop. Hi, Wayne.
Hi, how y'all doing today?
Good.
Okay, I have a question. It's been a few years since I've been into school, 1970 to be exact. And you know, I currently work, but I make about $20,000 a year. And I recently got interested in computers, and I've taught myself quite a bit about them, you know, building and stuff like that. I was thinking about, you know, trying to go to school for in that field, but I'm not really sure about the particulars, like, you know, schools to look at. And, you know, how would I decide which branch of computer field I'd like to try to get into? Anything you could offer?
Yeah, a couple of suggestions for you, Wayne. First of all, in terms of what type of field to go into in computers, my favorite source is something called BLS, as in, you know, boy, Lewis School, BLS.gov, I believe. It's the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They offer something called the Occupational Outlook Handbook. And the reason that I love it is because it will tell you where the job trends are. And obviously, a lot of them will talk about computers, you know, technology, things like that. And it will give you an indication of what the fields are that you should go into. And so I think that's a really, really good thing to do first. And that is kind of I think the best place to start. If you Google job trends, things like that, you'll come up with some really good stuff. And I think that anything you do in the field using computers is most likely going to yield you some really good results.
Wayne, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Jane in Athens. Jane.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling about something that might be an urban myth, just in terms of timing of when you apply for a FAFSA. I heard that they actually give out Pell Grants or the money that comes through FAFSA in order of application. Is that true?
It is not true. What happens is if you don't apply by the deadline, then you risk not getting money. But as far as a Pell Grant is concerned, a Pell Grant is what's called an entitlement program, meaning if you qualify, you will get it as long as you apply by the deadline. So the fact that, and it's funny because one of the students I work with through a nonprofit said to me, he was told to sit up on New Year's Eve waiting for the clock to strike and hit submit. And I said, no, go enjoy your New Year's and do it, you know, a day or two later. It's not going to make any difference whatsoever, as long as it's by the deadline.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that.
Sure.
Jane, thanks a lot. Well, it sounds like an exciting New Year's Eve. Let's go to Regina in Clifton Park. Regina.
Yes, hi. Linnell, I wanted to ask you a quick question about, you were talking about extenuating circumstances. If you feel that you have some extenuating circumstances that would merit consideration, do you recommend sending a letter to all the schools your child has applied to now, as opposed to waiting till they get accepted and choose a school and then discussing it with them?
I would not wait. This is another really simple question. Don't wait. And the reason is because, again, you know, if you wait, you run the risk. If you wait particularly until a kid has decided that they're going to go, your child has decided they're going to go to this school, you risk not having the school not having any of their money left.
Right.
And number two, if financing the college education is part of the decision, then you will want to do that now so that you know what you're dealing with and
right.
what the
okay.
cards are that are on the table. So
okay.
I think
some of that extenuating information is given, or they give you a place to give it in the CSS profile.
That's right.
But not in the FAFSA. So
that is exactly correct.
So whether they have the profile or not, would you send a second, follow-up letter?
If it were me, yes, I would. Simply because A, the box on the FAFSA is not, or on the profile rather, I'm sorry, is not a big box. And again, whenever I have made a change, I have always had to ask people, I need the dollar amounts and the dates. Mm. And so, unless you've told them, everything you need to tell them, I would absolutely follow it up in writing, and then I would follow
it
up.
And be specific.
I would be very specific. If they don't want the information, they'll not use it.
Okay.
But better that than them either A, not knowing and assuming, or B, mm-hmm. having to chase you down to get it because now
right.
you're just kind of adding layers.
Okay. And for example, one of the things would be still paying off college loans from the older brother who went through college a couple of years ago.
I would tell them. And then it becomes up to them as to whether they choose to make an adjustment for that. But at least you're giving them the information and letting them make that decision instead of you making it by not providing it.
Gotcha.
Okay.
Thank you.
Regina, thanks a lot. All right. Well, I guess we're just about out of time for calls. We only have about 30 seconds left. Any wisdom you'd like to impart before we get out of here?
I think that, I have a high schooler now, and so I kind of look at going to college and paying for college in a whole other light. And
a more painful light.
It's slightly more painful, yes. But I think that the important thing is for the students, be interesting. Do something. Be passionate about something. These are communities. They want students who are going to support that sense of community, and they want interesting people. Being an interesting person also then may help you with some financial aid stuff. It's easier to justify giving money to a student who I know is going to enhance my sense of community.
Yeah.
And it takes a little patience. It takes a little persistence. But I think the value of a college education is still pretty undisputed, whether that's at a two-year school or a four-year school.
Linnell Engelmeyer, a terrific job again. The website is collegeappwizard.com. It's collegeappwizard.com. www.voxpop.com. I guess we'll see you toward midsummer, eh?
I think so.
Very good. Support for WAMC comes from Hudson Valley Bounty, an initiative of the Hudson Valley Agribusiness Development Corporation, promoting Hudson Valley farms, wineries, restaurants, and more. HudsonValleyBounty.com. Bel Air Mountain Ski Center, now managed by the New York State Olympic Regional Development Authority, New York's Winter Snow Park, belair.com. And Richards Fuel and Heating, East Hampton, Massachusetts, providing high-efficiency gas and oil heating systems to the Pioneer Valley for over 45 years, now expanding into the Westfield area, richardsfuel.com. Thanks again for being with us on Vox Pop. Sorry if you didn't make it through. Remember, the conversation continues online at WAMC Vox Pop on Twitter and on Facebook.com/WAMC Radio. Our engineer today, Zach Malloy, calls answered by Colleen O'Connell. Patrick Donges is our producer. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, oh, hold on to your seats. It's the return of the Science Forum. It's been a while, let me tell you. So we'll see you for that one. Stay tuned for a news update.